Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy, and today we're talking with Cleo Andrus, an assistant professor of geography and an associate with the Institute for Cyber Science at Penn State, and C. Liu, a doctoral student in geography. Liu and Andrus recently used artificial intelligence to study and compare how people around the world decorate their homes. They found that while people tend to follow cultural trends when it comes to beautifying their homes, they don't always do what's expected. Cleo Andrus and C. Liu, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Before we get into the details of how you did this study and what you found, can you explain how you came up with this idea of studying homes in more than 100 cities?
Well, I think that naturally we want to know how other people live in other places. That's a big reason why we travel to other places, to get to see what cultures are like. And just looking at a map can tell us, you know, is this country big? Is it small? Is it located on the water? Is it landlocked? What places is it next to? Is it near the equator? But it doesn't always tell us, you know, what the people's lives are like there. And we can look at, like, the CIA World Factbook, or we can look at online statistics about mortality rates, GDP, et cetera, but it still doesn't really get us to what that individual life looks like.
Right. So when we're traveling somewhere or dreaming about traveling somewhere, oftentimes you look and you see what other pictures people have mm-hmm. posted on websites or in their blogs to try to get a sense of the feel of the place you're going. And so, C, did that interest you too?
Yeah, exactly. Like when I travel, I usually like to use those online platforms like Airbnb. So I live in other people's houses. And every time when I go to different neighborhood, I feel like the interior design, how they decorate their rooms, is like totally different style. When I was living in Seattle, one lady decorated her living room with a lot of books, and it's cooking books because she's really into cooking. And when I moved to another neighborhood, it's like very technical, like fancy room, and they listing that on the Airbnb as, I couldn't remember the exact name, but like super nerdy techie room or something like that. Yeah, so when I move in, they have a lot of like big screens of televisions and super fast internet. So that makes me feel like, yeah, people in different neighborhoods, different cities, different countries, maybe their culture and their background would affect how they decorate their rooms. And I want to know that whether we can use some kind of quantitative methods to see that. So yeah, that's how that motivated me to also take part into this research.
And Cleo, you've said it was like people around the world invited you into their living rooms.
That was a really cool part of it, because usually when we get to see pictures online when we travel, they're often of the interiors of hotels that we might stay in. And those are decorated by corporations and they're decorated for visitors. But the cool thing about Airbnb is that they're decorated mostly by the locals.
So while they might be trying to appeal to people coming to stay in their home, it's still their home.
Yes. And we were very careful to use only places where there was also another resident there. So we only used Airbnb rentals where you could be offered a room in a home. So not the entire place.
Okay, interesting. So if I'm renting a home, but I don't actually live there, I'm just doing it specifically as a rental, then it's not going to be as homey.
We think not. That's what we got from blogs online about how to decorate your home for Airbnb.
So you ended up analyzing the furniture and decorations of about 50,000 living rooms from 6 continents, and you started with more than 1 million photo images using this deep learning. It sounds like you almost had to train the computer to identify this is a painting or this is a decorative piece of furniture. How did you do that?
It's something, if we use fancy term, it's called like transfer learning. Like there's some kind of program there. Like they have already been trained by other computer scientists to learn that whether, like for example, a photo is a cat or a dog or is something like that. It's like a kid has already learned some mathematics and then you ask them to do something a little bit different, but it's still math. Like we train those programs to learn to classify whether it's a living room, whether it's a, let's say, kitchen. And then from the living rooms, we see whether it's a photo there, whether it's a poster there, or whether it's a plant there. So it's more like we train some of the pre-trained programs who can learn like whether it's a cat or dog to learn something different, doing a different task.
Okay, it sounds like an incredible amount of data. How did you do that?
First, we got some help.
Yeah, so For the raw data, it's like we collect them from some portal from Airbnb that open to like the public that you can request data from there. And for the training data, it's like we have help from some volunteers of students and also from the online platforms, like people can help you label whether it's a living room or it's a kitchen, or like whether it's a photo or it's a plant or it's a poster or it's some just a piece of decoration.
So to determine whether the room was a living room, a bathroom, etc., we had some undergraduates come and help us. We also put the images on Mechanical Turk.
So does that mean somebody else can come in and help out?
Yes, that means that we had a slew of anonymous helpers go in and say whether this was a living room, whether it was an office, et cetera, and we put that training set into the classifier to help it learn and then pull out the living rooms.
So once you helped it learn, then was it able to do it? It's the computer program was able to do it itself for the remaining. So you didn't have to have people doing 50,000 living rooms.
No.
Nope.
And you chose living rooms rather than bedrooms or kitchens. Why?
We thought that living rooms, since they're a communal space, they would best reflect the culture of the interior designer, who was mostly the resident. The bedrooms are and bathrooms, et cetera, are more utilitarian. And people's, you know, creativity, color, design often is shared in the living room.
And one of your key findings is that people's decorating tends to follow the tastes in their regions. Is that right?
Yes. So different countries, the cities in different countries with different cultural background and also different geographical locations will have like different ways of decorating their rooms. So one of the very like obvious but kind of surprising finding was that cities with like higher latitude would have more plants indoor.
Yeah, we found that plants were a really popular thing to have in Scandinavia.
Interesting. Is that surprising?
It was surprising. We didn't think we would find that. And in China.
Yeah. So at first we thought, yeah, maybe because like some city they're in cold places, so maybe people want to put more plants inside. And for cities in more warmer places, they already have a lot of plants like nearby their homes, so they might not really want to bring the plants in. And also plant may like cause some kind of bugs inside the room, so you don't really want those.
So if it's hot and tropical outside, you don't want to necessarily bring the plants inside and all their guests with it.
Yeah. And also maybe some culture thing, like in Asia, people maybe like to put more plants inside the room because they don't really have those kind of large backyard in their houses.
And you also found that, for example, more wall art in Italy, is that right? And vibrant colors in India. So it's just these trends across the world.
Yeah, India and Morocco tended to have really vibrant colors. And we were surprised that we found more vibrant colors in Japan than we had originally thought. We had always thought of Japan as more of a minimalist, like natural interiors, and we were interested in finding that they were pretty bright inside.
So some of your findings contradict perhaps our preconceived ideas about what the homes in these places will look like.
A bit, yes. And we also found that there was a lot of art and a lot of books in South America, too, that we were really interested in that finding.
The artsiest cities, Delhi, Milan, Naples, Sao Paulo, and then also we have one United States city, I guess, made it in the top 10, Charleston. Is that right? Was it fun to just have these lists and see where the different cities came out?
It was a lot of fun, absolutely. And we also, we kind of did an interior analysis of some cities in the U.S. too, and we found that, you know, Houston was the least decorated city that we found.
And were there any other findings that you found particularly interesting? You were talking about some of the indoor plants in the colder areas and then less bright colors in some of the places with these warm climates.
Oh, we found that some of the island countries tended to have few bright colors. And I thought that that was a little bit counterintuitive as well, as you seem to think of these countries like Fiji and stuff as being very vibrant. But they tended to be more towards more subtle designs.
Yeah, I saw that and I was wondering, oh, well, maybe that's because it's so beautiful and lush outside that inside you have the opposite.
It's very possible, yes.
Yep.
Is it hard not to just speculate about all the reasons when, of course, that's not what your study is finding, the kind of the why? But
we are careful in the paper to not speculate, absolutely.
Yeah, and it also could maybe be some kind of bias of the data set we're using. Yeah, because we tried our best to make the data set to be like a better representation of how people decorate their own rooms, but because they're like the rooms renting out to other people, so there could be a little bit bias, but we tried our best. Yeah.
What do you think the most important takeaway from the study was? Why is this important?
Yeah, for me, I think the most interesting and meaningful part to me is like in different cities, how people's socioeconomic status doesn't really decide at how much effort they would put into decorating their rooms. So it's like no matter you have higher income or lower income, no matter you went to college or not, you just decorate your room as much as you want. So that's the thing that makes me feel actually kind of happy about. Yeah, I feel like, yeah, people can do whatever they like. They have a lot of creativity no matter what their background are. So that's kind of thing I feel like really like make me feel inspired.
So you actually were able to compare different socioeconomic status to find out, okay, are people who are considered upper middle class decorating more than or less than people who are middle class?
In six U.S. cities, we did that. So we compared our findings to census data in the six major cities. And it turned out that some places that were very wealthy decorated very austere, in a very austere way. And then some neighborhoods that were less wealthy were still very ornate in their decor.
So it sounds like you think then the results are that it's independent. How much people decorate is independent of how much money they have.
Yes, we did not find any correlation there.
Yes, but one thing to note is we didn't really tell whether the decoration is expensive or not. We just say like how much effort you put into your decoration. So it's like how many things you have in your living rooms. So maybe people with higher income would use more expensive stuff. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, the background doesn't really influence you, like how much effort you can put into decorating the rooms.
Why do you think for someone who is interested in how people live and how people decorate their homes and appreciate their homes, why do you think the information matters? How does it help provide a better understanding of it?
Which part of the information?
Just your findings that the decoration people tend to decorate where like those around them, and mm-hmm. it varies by different places. But on the other hand, your income status doesn't mean you decorate less or decorate more.
We only found the income status aspect to be salient within the United States. Outside of the United States, it did seem like wealthier countries did have more decor.
Yeah.
We did notice that.
Yeah.
It was only within U.S. neighborhoods that we noticed that variation. So it's kind of a yes and a no there.
That's interesting. So it was more democratic, can we say, in the United States?
Yes, that's right. That said, we didn't dive into internal neighborhoods in the other cities.
Yeah, it's also like it's a different scale. So for the whole world, we're looking at the cities. But for the six United States cities, we look into the neighborhoods. So it's kind of different scale. So it might lead to like the yes and no, like different perspective of the question.
If you're just joining us, this is WPSU Take Note. I'm Ann Danahy, and we're talking with Cleo Andrus, an assistant professor of geography at Penn State, and C. Liu, graduate student. Liu and Andrus have used artificial intelligence to study and compare how people around the world decorate their living rooms. Cleo, an example of other research that you've done is looking at urban development in the United States and where it happens and why. And you had some really interesting findings. For example, chain operations tend to go near highways. Okay, that makes sense. But also that restaurants cluster near water. What do you make of that?
Well, this is some really interesting research that I'm collaborating on with former graduate student Sarab Rahimi and Professor Bing Pan of Recreation Parks and Tourism Management. And we scraped over 800,000 restaurants from the Yellow Pages website, geolocated to the coordinate level at their address. And we were able to divide restaurants into what was considered a chain restaurant and what was considered an independent restaurant. And we found that chain restaurants tend to be near highways and major road intersections. Notably, this is probably part of the American legacy of like Howard Johnson's, et cetera, and having chains on those major thoroughways. And then the strategic location placement of fast food restaurants on street corners where there's a lot of cars going through them.
But what about the idea that these restaurants are going near water and other findings like that?
So walkability and nearness to water were the top correlates with independent restaurants. And we thought that this creates a nice ambiance for the restaurant and the patrons to go there. It's very cozy. The land value might be a little bit higher in these locations. And the experience isn't just sort of utilitarian, like I'm on the road, I need to get something to eat, but they want to have more of a dining experience and an ambiance.
So when you're starting research like that, do you kind of come up with your hypothesis like, oh, it seems like it would make sense that restaurants would want to have that ambiance and be near the water, and then see if that the numbers actually bear that out?
So this study I thought of when I was living in Singapore, and I noticed that there were a lot of chains there and that it was sort of hard for people to start up their own bookstore, or people to start up their own record store, et cetera. There wasn't a whole lot of like people's names on the signage there. It didn't seem like everybody had an equal chance to really express themselves and their menu and their cuisine. In some places it did, but in some places it didn't. So I was wondering, you know, do we do that in the U.S.? Like, if I wanted to open a restaurant and make the menu and be in charge of who works there, are there a lot of environments that have clusters of these types of people's, quote, dream restaurants? And we found that downtown areas are still a really stronghold for those types of things.
So there is room for that type of more personalized local growth and development as opposed to just chains everywhere.
Yes. Yes, there definitely is. And I do think that there could be a little bit more policy inviting in independent stores to keep places local and to keep places from seeming like this is just anywhere.
That's a very timely issue in State College, which is seeing kind of a boom right now in growth. There may have been a quiet period, but if you just walk around downtown, you see a lot of growth happening right now. Do you think it will naturally continue in a way that's home to local businesses? Or do you think, you have to kind of step in and make sure that that happens, or else you could risk seeing all those chains come in?
Yeah, we definitely don't want State College to turn into a place that is any place, you know, where we look around and we see signage that is like we're in a mall somewhere and we see replicable branding everywhere, because then what's the point of being here? We really want to have unique representation of any sort of commercial that really makes State College State College, and it makes people want to come here. It makes us feel like we're connected to our city, and I do think that we need intervention to make sure that that happens.
Your lab has looked at a lot of other topics, too, and you did one study on cross-party cooperation in Congress. And I know that was from a few years ago, but it just seems particularly timely right now. And you found that the number of cross-party votes when a Democrat votes for legislation that a Republican sponsored, or vice versa, that has decreased dramatically in recent times. And I'm just going to throw one number out there from your study. You found that between 1967 and 79, there were more than 10,000 instances of representatives crossing party lines. So I'm a Republican and I support a Democrat party legislation. Mm-hmm. But that's dropped to 1,500 between 2001 and 2010 of the cross-party vote. So significantly dropping. And you also found that geography did not make much of a difference. What do you make of the findings? And is there any way to know? I would intuit that that's still the way it is today.
Yeah. It was kind of a really interesting finding. That study started here at Penn State in about 2010 when I was looking at the year, I think 2008 or 2006, one of them, and I noticed that the voting patterns, like whether you agreed or disagreed, were completely bimodal, meaning that either you agreed all the time or you agreed never. And I expected to see like a normal distribution, like a bell curve, but I actually saw two humps. And I was in our building, I was in Walker Building, and I ran down the hall to tell my collaborator, Wei Lo at the time. And I was like, this is crazy. And so we looked at it for years and we saw that it used to not be like that. It used to be more of that bell curve. So today it's really hard to comment on anything political because I think that a lot of the rules are changing quite quickly. But in terms of the geography and the congressional districts, it seems as though congressional districts used to have a very unique fingerprint. They used to have their own portfolio of needs that they sent their congressional representative to Congress to represent them for. But today it's really just two sides of a coin. Either your district is Republican, and so you get this bag of issues, or your district is Democrat, so you get this bag of issues. So you're losing that uniqueness and those unique needs and representation in your district. You're just saying, we're either this or we're that, which is too bad.
Right. So even if you're a very rural area, agricultural area, you might not be in the same company of other rural areas because you're just dividing along political lines.
Absolutely. And a lot of congressional districts have a lot in common. They share boundaries. They have similar issues. They have similar number of veterans, for example, or like you're saying, agriculture. But depending on which way they tipped, those things are going to be represented completely differently.
Hmm. Well, when people talk about geography, what comes to mind is often maps. It talks about borders in different areas and whether they're mountainous or have rivers and lakes. And I know for myself, I wouldn't, when thinking about a geography department, necessarily think about this type of research, looking at these personalized decisions. See, can you start and just talk a little bit about what attracted you to that, to be in geography in this way?
So we study a lot about cities. Our lab is called Friendly Cities Lab. So city is a big part of what geography studies. So we think that what makes a city most intelligent and what most important about cities are the people who are living in the cities, like how they travel, how they go to work, how they connect with other people, and how they think about different places in the cities and how they interact with them. So that's why we study a lot about like people's behavior in city, their connections, and we try to use our studies to make people understand better about how people behave in cities and also try to solve some kind of emerging issues or problems that happen in there to improve people's urban life. So that's why we do a lot of studies like this.
And Cleo, when you went into geography, did you have this kind of more looking at the human behavior in mind?
No, I didn't. In fact, I'm always concerned about using the term human behavior because there's so many people who know way more about it than I do. But one of our jobs in geography is to make the world a better place and to help improve people's quality of lives. And everyone in the department does that in one way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether it's climate change or whether it's nutrition, everyone does that. And our way of doing it is to take a look at interpersonal relationships and see how the built environment can work to support those relationships.
And I think I saw one talk you gave and you said even from a very early age you were just fascinated by geography. Is that right?
Yes. I've heard a lot of people actually say that. I thought that I was a little unique in, you know, sleeping with a light up globe and being really obsessed with maps as a kid. But after reading a lot of our graduate admissions letters and statements of purpose, I've noticed that like dozens and dozens of our applicants say the same thing, you know, that ever since they were young, they've always been fascinated by maps. And so I'm in better company than I thought, and I'm very glad to hear that.
Going back to your recent research again on living rooms around the world, and you looked at six cities in the United States, and we talked a little bit about this, cross-referencing the what was in the rooms with the economic data. Can you just talk a little bit more about how that broke down along the socioeconomic lines?
Absolutely. So what we did is we measured, see, help me out here. We did median income percent with bachelor's degrees. We did a mixture of race.
Yes.
So different race and ethnicities. So you either got very in one category or a mixture in other categories.
Yes.
And then we had a fourth one.
We also had the median housing, I think.
House value. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And maybe one or two more factors. Yeah.
So we found that for the plants, for the wall art, for the decor, for the color, and for the books, so they didn't really, none of those could predict how many of, none of those input factors could predict how much of the decor or how much of the color, et cetera, they had. So we didn't find that, for example, we didn't find that African-American neighborhoods used more color. We didn't find that high income neighborhoods had more books. We didn't find any of those things.
And that was a little bit different than when you looked at it internationally.
Yes. Internationally, we did see quite a difference.
Yeah.
In, you know, countries with low education rates, we did see fewer books, things like that.
And I'm just peeking at some of your findings here. Right. So books, Milan, that was a top city.
Yes.
Buenos Aires, Paris, Chicago, got a U.S. city in there. And looking at bright colors, as you mentioned, down lower on the list, we have Houston and Oxford in the U.K.
We also found that the Middle East kind of had less stuff in it, too. Which we also found was interesting, as well as parts of Russia. And we were just surprised at some of the findings, but since we're not really experts on interiors and couldn't find a whole lot on interiors in the academic world, we found so much on how architecture changes.
Right.
So much on that.
Yeah, it seems
but
like
not interiors.
It seems like you've just tapped the surface of what you might be able to learn with this. Do you know what you might be studying next?
We have a number of projects that are really exciting.
Yep.
So two of them actually have occurred in State College. One is about romantic relationships. So we've surveyed over 100 people online to ask them about what places support their relationships the most and what State College could do to make their interpersonal relationships better, romantic relationships. So these are married couples, these are couples that live together, these are couples that are dating but live apart, and we know about where they live, and we know the amenities that they use the most. And so we're really learning the cool places in State College that make romance happen. And this is really important in the era of online dating and Netflix and people staying at home. So we're really interested in that.
And also I imagine it would be important to towns and cities if they want to continue to attract people and be vibrant and have that population.
Absolutely. And we want people to be able to make really good memories, too. So we found that restaurants and bars were really, really important for relationships. We also found that outdoor spaces were crucial. So places like the Arboretum, people listed that a lot
as being
at Penn State as being really important for their relationship. People also listed Mount Nittany and going hiking as being really important for their relationships. And the least important things that people listed were like nightclubs.
Interesting.
And class. And places of worship. We didn't get a whole lot of those either.
That's a little bit surprising.
Yes, it was a little bit surprising.
Is State College doing well in some ways, or less well in other ways?
It's doing great for romantic relationships. they say that, you know, they want more this, more that, sometimes better transportation, cheaper flights, etc. But in terms of having the infrastructure to support romance, I think that people are saying that State College gets an A.
Cleo Andrus and C. Lu, thank you both for coming and talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Cleo Andrus, an assistant professor of geography and an associate with the Institute for Cyber Science at Penn State, and C. Lu, a doctoral student in geography. Lu and Andrus recently used artificial intelligence to study and compare how people around the world decorate their homes. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.